Good morning. One of the great things about sitting in the front row at this church is you get surrounded by sound. You get to hear all of you singing and the band in front, and it's this great experience. I love that we sing so loud here. It's really nice to hear. So good job. Several years ago, I used to be on this side of things playing in the worship band at PBC when I was in college. So special shout out to the college students here. In those days, though, I looked a little different. Some of you remember I had long hair, it was past my shoulders, it's kind of curly. People actually would ask me if I permed it, which I thought an odd question, because even if I did, I wouldn't say yes. But I remember this one time in college when we had our freshman dorm had this event where we invited somebody to come teach us how to tie-dye t-shirts. And so this person came, and he looked a bit like I did. We kind of had the same hairstyle going on, although I'm pretty sure his had the help of some less than legal substances, where mine was all natural. So after we tie-dye t-shirts, I kind of stuck around talking to him, and we were chatting, and he started telling me about this commune in Palo Alto, where people live what he called a free life. And he looked at me and he said, "You'll find lots of people like you there." And I've wondered about that comment for some time. What type of person did he think I was? People who perm their hair, apparently, yeah. And so it's interesting, though, because he seemed to acknowledge that I was different, that I maybe stood out from the crowd, but then he told me about a place where I wouldn't stand out, where I would be among similar types of people. I think we usually prefer to be around people like us. It's not a good experience often to be different than everyone around you, to stand out as unique. We're in the middle of a series right now on the biblical book of Daniel called When Kingdoms Collide. We've been looking at this book and thinking about, as Juan mentioned, the reality that we live in two kingdoms at once. We live in the kingdom of man that defines most of our everyday experiences, our jobs, our families, our schools, whatever it is that occupies our time. But then there is the kingdom of God. Then there is this belief that the creator of the universe cares about our daily lives, that he sent his son Jesus to be incarnate, to be God himself, and to die so that we could be part of this eternal experience. If you believe in Jesus and you live in the Silicon Valley, then you are different. You stand out in some ways from the crowd. That's one of the reasons we come here and worship on a Sunday morning, because there are people like us here. And it's safe and comfortable to be around people who are similar. But then, what does it look like to be different, to be in the world, to be living in communities and schools and workplaces where we are not like others? I spent a lot of time this past summer visiting family in Texas. And one of the things that it reminded me of is how uniquely different it is to follow Jesus here. A lot of you are familiar with Texas. You've been there or you're from there as well. And you know that Christianity is much more common there. It's much more embedded into the culture. And there are some downsides of that as well, but it feels normal to be a Christian. Whereas here, I think it feels odd, feels strange. There's a recent Barna poll in 2012 where the Bay Area was ranked 90th out of 96 cities for being the least Bible-minded in terms of its people. Being a Christian in this area makes you different. Now, people, by and large, don't go to church in this area, but that doesn't mean they don't worship, because everybody worships. The issue is not whether you worship, but who you worship. So the reality for us is not just living among people who don't worship the God that we might worship, but it's living among people who worship other gods, different things, or different people. There's plenty of worship going on in the Silicon Valley. It's just not about God. So we have to figure out how to live in a culture where everyone worships something other than God. What do we do when everyone worships? This morning, we're going to look at a story in chapter 3 of Daniel that will help us explore an answer to that question. It's a story about a courageous group of three young men who faced exactly that type of situation. A setting where everybody worshiped one thing, and yet they had the courage to stand up and refuse to worship. As we look at their story, we're going to think about the situation they faced, and we're going to think about whether we face similar situations. We're going to look at how they responded and think about how we might respond. We're going to look at how God met them in their response, and then we're going to look at what that said to the community around them. My hope is that these three men become a bit of an example for us, that they become an inspiration for us, that we can learn how to be willing to be different in our culture, how to follow Jesus in Silicon Valley. I think their example will give us courage, and ultimately it'll help us to find God. So the story begins with our friend, King Nebuchadnezzar. I'll read Daniel 3, verses 1 to 7. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning, fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So Nebuchadnezzar kicks things off by building an image of gold. Coming off the story last week, this is a bit of a letdown. Last week we saw a dream that Nebuchadnezzar had where there was a statue whose head was made of gold. And the purpose of this dream was to remind the king of how fragile earthly kingdoms are and to point the king to the durability of the eternal kingdom of God. Well, I think Nebuchadnezzar got the first message, but not the second. I think he realized that his own kingdom was fragile, and his efforts here were meant to address that issue. In order to build some type of unity, he came up with this idea. And it's actually a very good idea. If you think about his role, he was the king of an empire that had conquered many different peoples, many different cultures, many different ethnicities, many different languages. His job was to unite them into one empire and hold them together. So he's trying to come up with ways to join people in unity. The various lists of positions and the list of musical instruments that was repeated in this passage both refer to various positions and instruments across the cultures that Babylon had conquered. So what he's trying to do is bring people together around one idea. This event is like the poster you might see at McDonald's advertising, "You can work here." And if there's four people on the poster, there will be a Caucasian, an Asian American, a Latino, and an African American. Because the goal is to say that we are a diverse community and we all work together, held together by the glory of McDonald's, right? That's what Nebuchadnezzar is trying to do. We are a diverse community held together, and we are Babylon. See, he knew that worship brings people together. Worship creates loyalty. He didn't have any religious interest. That's why we're not even told what the image was of. It didn't matter what they were worshiping. It just mattered that they worshiped the same thing, because that would pull them together. Our culture does the same thing. I picked on Google at the beginning of this series, so I'm going to pick on Apple a little bit today. A few weeks ago, Apple unveiled their newest line of products, a new iteration of the iPhone and the all-new and much-anticipated Apple Watch. Now, Apple makes good products, but their greatest strength lies in creating loyalty. Apple doesn't just want you to buy their products. They want you to be an Apple kind of person. And they're really good at creating that kind of mentality. They actually use the same techniques that Nebuchadnezzar did. They hold large events where a diverse group of people gather together. They gradually unveil a manufactured product, and people ooh and ah. And then those people line up to sacrifice to this product. In fact, they camp out the night before to be the first person to be able to sacrifice to this new product. If you were able to magically transport someone from 6th century Babylon to an Apple launch event, they would know exactly what was going on. They would have no idea what a smartphone was, but they would recognize worship when they saw it. And they would know that people build beautiful temples to house their idols. And they would say, this is what I know. This is worship. And they would want to do it too. They would want to worship the same thing because they would see everybody else excited and gathered together. They would see the power of this product to draw people together, to get people excited, and they would want in on it. They would want to be a part of it. Living in the technology age means that you need to know certain acronyms in order to function properly. There's a story going around the internet about a mother who texted her son, "Your aunt just passed away, LOL." And her son texted back, "That's terrible. Why would I be laughing?" And his mother was confused until she realized that LOL meant laughing out loud. She thought it meant lots of love. So in our culture, you need to understand these acronyms. Well, there's an acronym that people use to describe the kind of pressure that people feel when something's being worshipped like that. It's called FOMO, F-O-M-O. I can allow the college students to educate us later on this. But this is the fear of missing out. People are afraid to miss out on what everybody else is enjoying. If there's a group that's all excited about something, that's all keyed up, that says, "This is the best thing ever," you want to be in on that. You don't want to miss out on what everybody else is experiencing. The question for us then is, what kinds of situations do we face like this? Where everybody is excited about something, where their excitement and their loyalty start to look a whole lot like worship, where the pressure to conform, the pressure to be a part of it is so strong that we are drawn into that. What does everyone around you worship? Intellect? Achievement? Being busy? The latest gadget? Money? Cars? Positions? What is it that you're tempted to be a part of? I think for each of us, it's different. We all have things that we're susceptible to in particular ways that we're drawn towards. What is it for you? What are you worried about missing out on? What are you tempted to be a part of the crowd around? We all face these temptations. The question is, how do we respond? What do we do when we are invited into this kind of worship? The next section of our story answers the question. And it's interesting because the way the story is told, at first we don't know what happens to Daniel and his three friends. We are told only in verse 7 that all the people fell down and worshiped. And so right away we're worried. Did these guys do it too? Did they succumb to the pressure? We only find out that they didn't when the other advisors of the king come and rat them out. They come to King Nebuchadnezzar and they say this in verses 12 to 14. "There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up?" He's astounded by this. And he says that he's going to throw them into the fiery furnace where no one can save them. So they say this in 16 to 18. "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, 'O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Now, we have to assume that Daniel wasn't in the area where this happened because we don't hear of him. But these three friends were, and they got caught up in this situation. They refused to bow to this golden image. It's not like the picture in the children's Bible, though, where everybody's lying down and they're standing up and it's super obvious, because Nebuchadnezzar doesn't find out that they refused until these other guys rat him out. See, these three men had recently been promoted to a high position in Babylon, so the other advisors were jealous. They wanted to see them brought down, so they come to the king telling him, "These three people aren't playing ball. They pay no attention to you." And this is classic peer pressure. It's not the authority up top that makes you conform. It's the people around you. It's the excitement. It's the expectation. It's the incredulity that you might not join in. How could you not worship these gods? This is what drives us to be a part of things. We sometimes talk about peer pressure as though it's an adolescent thing that fades when you get older and more mature, but that's not the case. So many of our decisions are driven by the decisions of the people around us. These three friends faced incredible pressure to conform. They faced fear of missing out, and they faced peer pressure. They even faced the threat of death, but they stood up. They refused to worship. And we love the story of the lone voice who stands up for what he or she believes in the face of incredible pressure. It's the story of Chinese students in Tiananmen Square who stand up to an oppressive regime. It's the story of Rosa Parks, a young black woman who refused to give up her seat on the bus to a white passenger. It's the story of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who went back to Germany during World War II to support a resistance movement against Hitler. What do we stand up for? When are we the lone voice standing up in a crowd, refusing to go along with what everybody else thinks is completely normal? What are you willing to miss out on in order to do that? Not many of us will face situations as drastic as these three men, but we will face situations like this all the time. A Chinese-American friend told me a story about her dad, who was a faithful Christian. When his mother passed away, he attended the funeral in China. And in that culture, it's customary to bow at the casket and to worship the ancestors of the deceased. Now, I'm told that that's kind of a personal decision. Do you bow in respect, or does that equate worship? But this particular man, her father, decided he would not bow in order to make it clear that he worshiped only Jesus Christ. And it created all sorts of confusion and misunderstanding. People were offended. How could you not show respect to your mother who's passed away? How could you not show respect to your ancestors? But he was willing to miss out on that. He was willing to be misunderstood. He was willing to go against what was expected of him so that he could make it clear that he worshiped Jesus. What peer pressure do you face? What situations like that are true for you? Well, for the friends in Babylon, standing up didn't just mean they missed out on something. It meant they were punished for it. They suffered for it. Listen to verses 19 to 23. "Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated, and he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace was overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace." These guys were punished for their choice. They were punished for standing up for what they believe in. King Nebuchadnezzar is furious. He is so mad. The previous section says he was in a furious rage. Here it says the expression of his face was changed. Why is that? Why is this such a big deal to him? Why is he so angry? It's the issue of loyalty. He's just promoted these three men. He's just made them high in his kingdom. He's just given them power. And now they're saying, we're not going to play your game. We'll be faithful to you, but we won't be controlled by you. We're not going to do what you tell us to do. Now see, the powers of the kingdom of man work through promise and fear, the carrot and the stick. You'll get good stuff if you play along. You'll get bad stuff if you don't play along. It's what the king is doing. If you worship this image, you'll be part of everything. You'll be part of this grand effort to be Babylon the Great. If you don't worship, you'll die. The worst stick there is, the final punishment. But these three friends don't need Nebuchadnezzar's carrots, and they're not afraid of his stick. They say, we don't care about being part of Babylon, and we're not afraid to die. Because of that, they can stand up. That's why their statement is so powerful, where they say, our God is able to deliver us, but even if not, let it be known that we will not serve your gods. They've completely undermined Nebuchadnezzar's power. He can't do anything. He can't control them because they won't play along with his game. They're free. And he is mad about it. But this is what it takes to live well in the kingdom of God when it comes into conflict with the kingdom of man. A willingness to miss out on some of the promises that the kingdom of man makes, and a willingness to endure some of its threats. Following Jesus means enduring negative consequences. We might miss out on the carrots and get the sticks. So how does this work for us? How does this work in the kingdom of man that we live in? I'm always amused by the response that I get when I tell people I'm a pastor. I'll be having a nice conversation with somebody at a soccer game or a neighborhood event, and I'll ask them what they do for a living, and they'll tell me, and I'll listen. And then they'll reciprocate, and they'll ask what I do for a living, and I say, I'm a pastor. And they say, oh. They don't know what to do with that. The conversation just stops. It's over. It's this awkward silence. They're not quite sure how to react. I've sometimes thought about being creative in my answers and saying, oh, I'm a shepherd, and seeing what they do with that, you know? What kind of sheep do you shepherd? Or maybe I'm a spiritual advisor. Maybe that'd be a better answer. Never quite brought myself to be able to do that, though. So mostly I just say pastor, and they respond with this awkward quiet. One woman, though, even once said, people still do that? So there's a lot of ways that our culture might punish us for being faithful to Jesus, but one of them is just with awkwardness, an unsure pause, misunderstanding, confusion. People still do that? And on the surface, that doesn't seem so bad, right? If I had to choose a burning fiery furnace or an awkward pause, I would choose the awkward pause, probably. So it seems kind of unfair to compare them, except when you realize that for many of us, all it takes is an awkward pause. That's enough that we would be quiet. That's enough that we're afraid to stand out. Let's suppose there is someone trying to stop people from talking about Jesus. That person would say, why go to all the effort of making a fiery furnace if a little bit of awkwardness will do just as fine? We talked before about the acronym FOMO, fear of missing out. I'd like to introduce a new one, phobia. F-O-B-I-A, the fear of being incredibly awkward. I think this is what drives a lot of us in our culture. This is what drives us to conform, to be part of the crowd, to be afraid to stand up and to acknowledge, yeah, I worship Jesus. It's crazy. People still do it, and I'm one of them. It's worth remembering, though, that while we face awkward pauses, there are people in the world that face a lot more than that. There are people in the Middle East right now that are being killed for their faith. There are people in India and other parts of Asia that are being persecuted, physically abused, because they aren't afraid to stand up. These people are part of our family. They are our family in faith, and we owe it to them to support them, to remember them, to tell their stories. We're having an event next Sunday night to pray for Christians in the Middle East that are being persecuted. There's some details in your bulletin under the serve category. But if you would like to stand with brothers and sisters in the Middle East and pray for them, that's an opportunity to do so. These three friends in Babylon were willing to be different, even in the face of incredible punishment. They prayed for God to save them from it, but they acknowledged that even if he didn't, they would still believe. They wanted to make a statement about who God was. And most of you know how the story ends. In fact, they were saved. Here's verses 24 to 26. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, but I see four men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire. Someone else showed up in the fire. King Nebuchadnezzar couldn't believe it. Who is this person? And there have been all sorts of suggestions. Was it God himself? Was it an angel? Was it Jesus in some pre-incarnate form? But it doesn't matter exactly who it was, because it's clear that it was a representative of the God of Israel. God sent his presence to be with these three men in their suffering. God met them in the fire. And for centuries, this story has become a model for how God cares for his people when they're going through hard things. He doesn't save us out of the fire. He meets us in it. He comes alongside of us. He gives us his presence. You see this all throughout the Old Testament. You see it in the life of Jesus, with the Father himself filling Jesus with his Spirit. You see in the apostles as they suffered, and yet they knew that Jesus was with them. You see it in the early church. Peter from the New Testament was no stranger to being punished because of his faith. But he says this in 1 Peter 4:14. "If you are insulted for the name of Christ, you are blessed because the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you." God sends his presence to be with you in the midst of hard things. When you are willing to endure the stick, whether it is an awkward pause or a fiery furnace, Jesus is there with you. And you can know that Jesus endured the same thing and even more. He experienced the worst stick the world has to offer. So he knows about suffering. And he comes alongside of us to comfort us and just be with us, whatever we're going through. They might throw us into the fire, but God's with us in there. The reason is that something good happens when we are willing to endure suffering for the sake of Jesus. That's how our story concludes. Here's verses 28 to 29. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree. Any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way." This is incredible. It's the second time we've seen Nebuchadnezzar saying something positive about the God of Israel. And it's part of a process that over these first four stories, Nebuchadnezzar goes through, where he progressively sees more and more of who God is. And that is an incredible thing, that the evil king of Babylon, the icon of all that is against God, says, "Blessed be this God, for there is no other God like him." See, when God's people are willing to suffer for the sake of faith, God is made known. He is made real to a world that cannot see him and that can't fathom why anyone would go through such things. But they see that, and they see God. when we are willing to suffer, God is glorified. This is why Tertullian, one of the early church fathers, said this in AD 197, "The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church." Nothing demonstrates the reality of something more powerful than your willingness to suffer for its sake, to lay down something important to you, whether it's your social position or your money or your time or your life, to say that this is real. I was talking with a friend recently who's been married for several years, and in the last 3 months before they were going to get married, they decided to move in together. The biggest reason was because their families were pressuring them. They're saying, you'll save so much money by not having to pay double rent. Everybody does it anyway. It'll give you convenience. Come on, really. I mean, what's the big deal? You're going to get married anyway. Go ahead and do it. And so they did. They said, all right, you know, that makes sense. We're going to do that. But today, they regret that decision. Not so much because of what it meant to them, but because they realized that they missed an opportunity. They gave in to that out of fear. They gave in to the pressure of their parents, to the pressure of the culture around them. And today they realize that that set them off on the wrong foot. It started them off on this process of capitulating to what others expect of them rather than standing up. And in particular, they realized that they could have made a statement to their families that were saying these things to say, you know what? It will cost us. It doesn't make sense. It's not convenient, but there's a reason for it. And by saying that, they could have opened something up and said, this is how important God is and what it looks like to be faithful to him. But they're sad that they missed that opportunity. They realized it would have cost them. It would have cost them money. It would have cost them time. It would have cost them respect. But now they think that cost would have been worth it. When we're willing to be different, when we're willing to give things up, to miss out on what everybody else is enjoying, then we proclaim the reality of God's kingdom to his world. This is what Maria mentioned about green pastures, that their willingness there to sacrifice and work for the sake of people that need it has been a witness to the world around them that God is real, God is worth following, and other people want to say, who is this God? Why would you make these kinds of choices? When we are willing to suffer, God is glorified. Well, there wasn't anything particularly heroic about me being different when I had long hair. It probably wasn't even that different, and it certainly wasn't out of some deep moral conviction that I stood up. But today we've heard about three men who were that way, who were brave enough to face up to pressure and expectation and even threats in order to stand up for what they knew to be true. Nobody could believe it when they refused. It seemed like the stupidest thing in the world. It's just a little bow. Why not do that to save your life? But they didn't, and because of that, a whole group of people saw that their God was a different kind of God, that no one could save like he could. How are you being seduced to be part of the crowd around you? To be excited about all the things they're excited about, to play along with all that they play along with. What's it look like for you? What will it cost you if you refuse? Are you willing to spend that? Are you willing to stand up to say that you're different, to worship God and God alone? If you are, he will be with you. Jesus comes alongside. He comforts us, he goes through it with us, and then he's revealed in some amazing way to the world around us. Paul encourages us this way in 2 Corinthians 4:18. He says, "We look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal." Look to the eternal things. When everyone worships the temporal, stand firm. It will cost you, but in the end it will be worth it because God will be glorified. Amen.